You just tuned in to Set for Success with your host, Richard Lannan. And guess what we're going to do? We're going to continue our journey to create a roadmap to help you change your business, your career, and life. And we're going to do this through chatting with one person at a time to uncover people's lives, their business, their journey, their successes, so you can create the success that you deserve. And you do deserve to be successful. I actually want you to say that right now. I deserve to be successful. Awesome. Appreciate it very much. You know, I love quotes. You've been listening to me for a while. And you know, what do? I just sit down with a topic and I throw it into a search engine. I see what pops up and I go with something. So here's today's quote. In every success story, you will find someone who has made a courageous decision. Now, that was Peter Drucker who said that. And if you don't know who Peter Drucker is, he was an Austrian-born American management consultant, educator, and author whose writing contributed to the philosophical and practical foundation of modern business today. Not a pretty amazing sort of resume right there, a little bit of a bio. I think he wrote about 6 books or so and contributed to business thinking globally. Over the years, business has shifted a lot. And from Peter Drucker's time, no doubt things have changed quite a bit from the very first book that I actually read of his back in the day. And that's as far as we're going to put it, back in the day. But yeah, business has shifted a lot over the years. And there are tons of approaches that a person can take to create a business career for themselves. But one constant is making a courageous decision. A lot of entrepreneurs that I know did not start out as entrepreneurs. They actually had a full-time 9-to-5 job that whittled away at the very essence of what they felt themselves inside needed to be. I think that I said that one a little bit weird, but it works out. I think you get the point. Eventually making a decision to jump into the business world on their terms to create something out of nothing. They built a business that fit their need. Maybe fit a need, a marketplace need, or a need to be free and independent, a need to make a difference in the lives of themselves and the people around them. When it comes to business, your business, there are many options, from brick to mortar business, to virtual enterprise, to creating a space where people can gather, share, and establish a co-working community. Entrepreneurs are the backbone of our economic society, and small business from a social economic place creates opportunities for people to work together in community. I think sometimes people miss this point. Business is about relationships. But it all starts with learning to work together and to create a co-working mindset. So here's what we're going to do today. I gave it some thought about the show, and I was wondering who could share their ideas, their life, their business with us. This time I thought someone younger who has worked but has realized they wanted to do something that made a difference in their world. You could say that they had an eye for a tradition, yet a hankering for the future. They saw space as communal, lending itself to create relationships with work that would be more intentional, collaborative, holistic, and positive, creating a positive impact on the business community. So today I'm hanging out with Tara, and Tara is the establisher of Canoe Coworking. Tara, welcome to Set for Success today.
Thank you for having me, Richard.
It's awesome. You know, we were chatting before the show and just getting to know you a little bit, but let's start off right there. Why don't you just tell the listeners a little bit about you personally? Who is Tara?
Sure. So I became interested in business as young as 10 when I wanted to open a hot dog stand. Roasting hot dogs over an open flame didn't really fly with the health department. Began exploring my journey as I got a little bit older and went into business school and found a love and a passion for marketing. Moved to Alberta with my veteran husband and furthered that appreciation of showing off people's skills and assets through job development and socioeconomic development with specifics to people with high barriers. And it really hit home for me. Then going back home to Winnipeg, which is where I'm born and raised, I realized that there was a lot more that I could do and went into program development and really started this fire that became almost uncontrollable and realized I had a space to fill within my life, and that was entrepreneurship.
Okay, so you're obviously involved in entrepreneurship and you had a space to fill in your life. So let's just start there. What kind of entrepreneurial endeavors, if you look throughout, I mean, I love the hot dog stand example. I did some very similar stuff when I was a kid too. I think one of mine was, my best, most successful one was a haunted house, but that's a whole other thing, you know. But when you talk about your entrepreneurial endeavors, let's talk about the little things that you did along the way before we get to what you're doing today. Mm-hmm. What are some of the other things that you sort of did?
So I was involved in anything from retail sales and management. I became a career counselor, and then I went into the program management of a career development and counseling provincial program here in Manitoba.
So let's talk about the career counseling side, because I suspect that really sort of, I'm going to guess that it anchored you a little bit, and maybe use a different word, right? But that sort of need to help out community or people in that. What was your overall experience in the career counseling world that sort of helped contribute to your thinking today?
So it was really, you're quite right in the word anchoring. It was frustrating for me seeing people having to define success by somebody else's standards. So tons of government programs or policies, they have these little tick boxes where they define your success. And a lot of my clients were high barriered and their definitions were completely different. And I found that to be really upsetting, because shouldn't people be able to define their own future?
It's interesting you would say that, because over the course of my career and sharing with you, I've had the same challenge. I've had to rethink what success is based on people's definitions. You make reference, like several times just in their opening, you've made reference to, I think it was high barrier.
Yes.
Is that the term? I just want to make sure I got the term correct. What do you mean by high barrier?
So in socioeconomics or places that do community funding, high barrier can be a range of different issues, but is traditionally covered under people that might not have readily accessible avenues to programs or services. This could be anybody from a disability standpoint, women, people that have experienced abuse. In my case, it's also Indigenous peoples. Anything that falls around the realm of people that might have a harder time in society than what we might consider a day-to-day life.
Is there, this is going to be a bit of a strange question, not strange, is there like a bit of a macro approach, an overall approach to dealing with high barrier issues? And that's a pretty big question.
It's a good question. I believe that there is a macro approach when it should be a individual approach, because I call it the push versus pull strategy, where we're pushing our ideals onto a community that is already defined their ideals, or even as minuscule, what we might consider minuscule, but is a person defining their own success and their own barriers, and how we can collaborate with that one individual to create success.
I think when we come back, we should talk a little bit about, or listener, come on back. We're going to talk a little bit about push-pull principles and the impact it has on communities. This is Richard Lamb for Set for Success, and we'll be right back. Hello and welcome back. I am hanging out with Tara Everett. Did I get it correct?
You sure did.
Want to make sure I get your name correct. I mentioned that she's the establisher of Canoe Coworking. Now, just before the break, we were talking about this whole concept of push-pull strategies and the impact they have on communities. Could you define that a bit more and elaborate a bit more for us?
Sure. So when I started working with disadvantaged or high barrier communities, and my focus is primarily on people I can directly identify with, so Indigenous, women, youth, people with disabilities, and those who might have to access programs a little bit differently, I recognized that there was different barriers for each of these clients. And some of those could be anything from access to education to access to just programs and services, especially for our remote and northern Indigenous communities. Disabilities, these are people who would like to define their own methods of work and want to be contributing parts to the communities. And they're having a hard time finding that within traditional workplaces.
Okay, that's, you know, that to me, that makes sense. Okay, I mean, you're speaking a logic to me that makes sense to me, because of traditional, if we consider traditional business communities to sort of have their own structure, then, and you look at who works within those communities, then I would think that anybody outside of those communities would really struggle being part of that community.
Absolutely.
Yeah, hopefully, that, and that's what I hear you saying overall. You know, it brings a very interesting idea in terms of, you know, what we do with these communities. If you're looking at high barrier communities, and we've talked a little bit about, you know, identifying them, I mean, Indigenous, the women, youth, you've identified those three. Maybe what we can do is break down those three from a barrier perspective. Okay. So I guess the question would be is what are the barriers, say, for Indigenous? You know, what are the barriers for women? What are the barriers for youth? And again, those are pretty big questions, but...
Yeah, I mean, through my experience to the Indigenous aspect is I'm actually a 60 scoop survivor. So I was removed from my home and I never had an established relationship with my communities. And part of that is I started discovering the policies and really the silos that program dollars are placed in for business development, where if you weren't located here or there, you couldn't access funds. And then it became an issue of recognizing that if you're, in my case, from a community, you might not have access to funds if you don't know the right people or anything from Indigenous or First Nations versus Inuit versus Métis. They all have their siloed approach, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. However, it does create a division within the Indigenous community because we're all trying to access the same resources, but we can't do it collaboratively because you have to identify as one or the other.
Okay. And then, sorry, you have to identify as either Métis or Indigenous?
Right. So most of the programs that are designed for Indigenous personnel have to have a business ownership of 51% of one or the other. So if you were 51% First Nations, you would go to one funding body. If you were 51% Métis, you would go to another.
Okay. I want to ask you a question here, and this is more of a clarity question. I get this from people in just regular conversations. Sometimes I'm out talking to people and we're just having coffee and the question comes up, what is the difference between Métis, Indigenous, and First Nation? And even sometimes I don't know if I'm clear, and I'm wondering maybe you can help me with that or our listeners with that.
Yeah, so it depends on who you speak to in the community from, I know, surprising.
Yeah, that's why sometimes I feel I'm confused, but I think other people are confused too.
Right. So, and that's part of the reason why I'm really opening up my space to non-Indigenous people is so we can clarify these kinds of issues that non-Indigenous people may have. In my personal opinion of it, Indigenous is an umbrella term for the first peoples, so that would be status, Métis, and Inuit, as well as those that fall outside of those government-issued definitions, which would be our non-status brothers and sisters, or people that have been moved because of the residential school or 60 scoop survivors.
60 scoop survivors, not a term I'm familiar with as much. So we're going to talk about that in just a moment. Okay, so then we had 3 points. We had Indigenous, First Nation, and Métis. Mm-hmm. So I think I understand Métis because I have several Métis friends, and yeah, they made it very clear to me. I actually have quite a few Métis friends. But what about First Nations? How does that sort of fit in there?
Yeah, so generally with First Nations, your membership or your treaty number is established with a specific land entitlement group or a band, as they call it, a council. If you're not within the scope of that, then you become a non-status Indigenous person, meaning your parents or lineage has Indigenous or First Nations in it, and then you weren't able to qualify for a treaty number, or maybe you didn't want to.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I recall lots of people checking their lineage to figure that one out some years ago. And then Métis, we might as well go through all three. How would you define Métis?
So Métis is commonly misconstrued as you have one parent that's either European and one that is Indigenous. So there's an actual entire culture around the Métis peoples, specifically in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, wherever there was a really strong group. And they have their own defined cultural sets and protocols, their own elders, and their own communities. I'm not Métis, so I can't speak to it as much, but it's a very strong and unique community within the Canadian landscape.
You know, I think those are absolutely excellent definitions. I mean, I sort of put you on the spot there. We hadn't planned on you to answer those, but I appreciate you bringing some clarity because I thought that was a nice, I hesitate using the word simplistic, a nice, honest way to define them. That's probably the better word. You know, we're going to look at talking about a few other things because my question was about various barriers for different groups, Indigenous, women, and youth. So when we return, I think we should dig deeper into barriers. This is Richard Lamb for Set for Success. We'll be right back. Everyone, welcome back. We've been talking a bit about barriers, and with Tara, establisher of Canoe Co-working, and we're going to talk a bit about that a little bit later on. Interesting definition of barriers. I want to thank you for defining the whole term Indigenous, First Nations, and Métis in a very succinct manner. I thought it was very fluent. So thank you. But we had other barriers we were talking about. I mean, there's barriers to women, there's barriers to youth. So I think we need to maybe address those too, and then tie back in co-working and social economics to helping solve some of these challenges. So when you talk about barriers to women, what do you mean by that?
Well, as an entrepreneur and as a identified woman, it's really interesting to see the programs and services that are available to women specifically to try and close the gender gap. I don't have any statistics on me, but I can tell you that throughout the years, it is traditionally a men's role to open up businesses or to be in a leadership position within those businesses. So there are programs and services aiming to try and help women close that gap and be leaders that we know that we can be. That being said, there's still a huge gender gap that we need to close.
Do you, and I'm just curious, and this is, I understand there's a gender gap that you want to close, and so this is just a question. Mm-hmm. Do you think men are more inclined to become self-employed than women, or women want to be more self-employed than men? I know it's a sort of a bizarre question. I don't know enough information on it.
Yeah, I think based on the traditional roles of women in the family, being that within and I say this with respect to the colonization factor, is that women coming from European or communities where there is a really strong divide between the labor. Mm. So men go out and have the jobs, women stay home and have the children. And with this cultural shift we're experiencing, where more women want to be career driven and balance those two, or maybe they don't want to have children, there's going to be a shift in that dynamic. And that's exactly what's happening for people such as myself, where I value my career and my legacy is going to be through my career and what I leave behind for the youth and everyone as a whole. There's nothing to do with family in that.
Yeah, and I think I'm going to share this one with you, and I've got some ideas and thoughts on that one too. And I think I'm going to call it modern men, and I'm going to get a lot of pushback on this one. But I think men who establish themselves in the family, as part of the family, and are invested in their kids, can share part of that burden with women. So it balances out a little bit more.
Absolutely.
And I can only speak from, I'm going to speak on two angles here, because again, I like to think that we're having coffee, which we are. On the one hand, my spouse and I made a decision a long time ago to shift our careers and work from home. And that gave us an incredible life-family balance. And the other piece is that I spent 5 years of my career in entrepreneurial training, strategic planning, everything. 51% of all my classes, the programs I was doing, these were sponsored programs, were women. When I looked at my demographic, 52% were female and 48% were male. So my business demographic. And so my point is that I think there's been a lot of shift in that space. And I've seen it in workshops. I've seen it in business environments. I've seen it in other places. I'm not saying it's always perfect, but I have seen it in other places. So I just wanted to support you on your point. But I look forward to even more improvements in that space. Now, we also talk about barriers to youth. So let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, I think you defined the other two really well. What are the barriers for youth right now? And what is a youth?
So youth, honestly, it's a different definition depending on who you talk to. So the feds have a different definition for their programs, the province, locals. Generally, it's within the range of anywhere between 15 to as high as 35, depending on who you talk to. Mm. So my biggest concern for youth, especially trying to get into entrepreneurship or business ownership, is that so many of these programs require substantial amounts of capital, skin in the game, so to say. Mm. Track records, huge amounts of support, which many of them have, but when you're looking at the economics of youth nowadays with really high student debt loans, trying to finish education, how are we supposed to get these youth into positions of business ownership or entrepreneurship when they're barely able to make ends meet in a 9-to-5 job?
Yeah, when they're just paying the bills.
Exactly. And that's been a personal experience that I've had, which is I am ready to put my skin in the game with my my knowledge capital, what I'm willing to learn, what I'm willing to put forward. However, when I go to traditional banking institutions or even programs, they're saying, well, in order to access our program, you need to have capital. Mm. And it's not that I don't want to provide capital, it's that I don't have the means to do that. Mm. So now I'm looking at traditional or non-traditional ways of bringing that income forward so that I can have a level playing field with people that are 20, 30 years my senior. And I'm expected to go through the same program and same process that they are, which is infuriating and very upsetting because I have so much to give.
And I suspect that a lot of other people find themselves in the same situation. You spoke of non-traditional ways of potentially raising capital or finding ways to do things. What might be an example of a non-traditional way of doing things?
So in my case, it's primarily going to be crowdfunding.
Okay. That's where I thought we were going to go.
That's crowdfunding. That's where we're going. Yeah. So crowdfunding, sponsorship opportunities, these kinds of endeavors that are very time consuming and have to be thought out with a really strategic plan behind it to equivocate success. The reality is that I have had so many people in traditional banking say, yes, this is a great idea, but it's a new concept. And a lot of our youth are bringing new concepts to light or industries that we've never heard of. But because they're not a traditional industry, they're not being looked at in a serious manner.
In a serious manner, yeah. The asset structure and everything's a bit different. Capitalization and
absolutely,
there's a number of things that are going on. Now, this now opens up my next question. Because I suspect we're talking about creating a co-working business. Is that what you're talking about right now?
Yeah, and specific to my experience within the sphere.
So what is co-working? Let's start right there.
So co-working was defined back in 2005, and the first co-working space that was identified started in San Francisco. Right.
No shock there.
Yeah, no shock. It's always the West Coast. That kind of has trickled into a worldwide phenomenon where we're seeing upwards of 15% growth per year anticipated for the next 5 years of co-working spaces. And what they are is they're these collaborative community spaces where people share their skills and their resources to create better and healthier workspaces for anybody from freelancers to small businesses. We're seeing really large businesses starting to use co-working spaces, especially in the metropolitan areas.
Now, co-working spaces, is an opportunity for people to work on the same projects, or do they tend to work on different projects at a time? Like, can you give us a bit more of a visual of what a co-working space might look like? A day in the life.
A day in the life is completely dependent on the space that you're a part of.
All right.
So there's really niche spaces, like mine is going to be specific to the indigenous communities, or there's women located spaces, anything. But you'll see in a standard co-working space, there's going to be a receptionist that everyone can use, drop-in spaces, private offices, meeting rooms, boardrooms, you name it, it's there. And it's in a shareable format that everyone can use. And when you're working in freelance or as an entrepreneur, things can get lonely.
Yeah,
and we're dealing with a mental health epidemic where people are starting to work from home and they're trying to find this balance. I love working from home, but I miss my water cooler talk.
Yeah, the connection with people.
Absolutely.
So I think what we should do is talk about connecting with people when we return. Everyone, welcome back. I'm hanging out with Tara. We've been talking a lot about a lot of stuff, actually, everything from barriers, which has been a fascinating conversation to have with you, to different groups of people and the definitions of those groups of people. I always appreciate those conversations so much more. Importantly, though, we were talking about the challenges we're having in modern day society as we transition and change the way we work. And I think a lot of that, and you tell me what you think on this one, is technology driven. You know, I don't have to go to an office anymore. I really don't, you know, and I can go to my favorite coffee shop. Let's not say any names, unless they're local and they're small. We'll give them a little, I'll give them, yeah, I really like this place. Or we can just sort of work from home, or we can work in our car or whatever it might be. And we were talking a bit about the challenges, right? Mm-hmm. What are the deep challenges that you're seeing and experiencing? And you were talking a little bit about your own experiences and maybe with the people around you for your generation.
Right. So I'm an Indigenous youth. And although I didn't grow up within my community on reserves, what I've really identified as a self-employed person was that I am an ambivert, which means I need people and solitude to do.
I am too. We're going to check our numbers in a second.
Yeah, to see growth. Yeah. And I wasn't getting that at a home office. I also have a beautiful dog who likes to bark as a hound. Mm. And I was lonely. I was lonely all the time. And as somebody with mental health diagnoses, it wasn't healthy for me. And when I started putting together this drive and this need, I recognized that I need a community. And I wanted that support and that ability to look over to my neighbor and ask them that 5-minute question that I would have been able to ask any coworker. In the lens of an Indigenous person, we are coming from an area of sometimes very remote histories that can be very upsetting to a lot of people. And bringing that recognition and that cultural sensitivity to a space was really important to me.
And I think that has to do with your present project you're about to do. I want to go back to ambivert in just a moment. Love the word. But first, we're going to, let's go ambivert right away. We'll do it real quick. Most people will not know what an ambivert is.
Right.
But they will know what an introvert or an extrovert roughly is.
Right.
Okay. So there's definition. You know your test scores. Okay. Do you know what percentage of introvert versus extrovert you are?
I actually almost fall right in the middle.
Really?
Right. And the only time I really start switching to introverted is when I'm experiencing a lot of my mental health symptoms coming through. And then I need to take some time for myself and do self-care.
All right. So you're just a little bit more extroverted than introverted.
A little.
Okay. So I'm going to share. I'm ambivert. I'm 51% extrovert and 49% introvert. And I switch back and forth too. It's a great space to be in. So I understand you. Wow. I don't meet too many people that actually even know that word. So I appreciate it. Now, we're talking a bit about what you're up to now, right? Because, I've mentioned Canoe Co-working. And I think this is your latest entrepreneurial project. I'll put it in that framework for you. So tell us a bit about Canoe Co-working.
So the co-working sphere here in Manitoba is very limited currently. We're a conservative province, and we don't know new trends when we see them.
Yeah, Manitoba tends to be a little bit slower on the movement of things.
Just a smidge. So Canoe Co-working is going to be Manitoba's first Indigenous co-working space and the second worldwide.
Okay.
Yeah.
So where's the first one?
It's actually in Esquimalt in BC.
Okay. Okay. So then there's a Canadian footprint.
There is. They are a tri-council almost, where they are connected with the council for that particular Indigenous group. I believe a venture capital firm and a software company group. So I'm the only one doing it independently.
Independently. Okay. So they're all connected and are supported or sponsored with other groups behind them.
Precisely.
Other businesses behind them. So we're really getting into more of a vision of success is what I like to call it,
yes.
Right? So with the vision, how do you, let's start with the physical space first. How do you envision the physical space, which then lends to the working space, right, and the community space? Or is it the other way? Is it more the community space and then the physical space will follow?
I think it's both. I mean, when I talk about the physical space, it's what honors our community, and it makes me emotional to talk about it because I'm so excited.
And you're smiling.
Yeah. No, it makes me so excited for the people that will use it. A physical space to me is somewhere where there can be private or open conversations and collaboration a fully serviceable kitchen, because in the Indigenous culture, food is so important to us. And a lot of the places where you might host an event or a meeting actually don't allow outside food to be brought in. Mm. So that's really important for our community, which has wild game or a lot of health issues like diabetes, heart concerns. These are all things that lend to the community aspect. We're actually going to be the only space that will have a permanent elders lounge. So there's going to be a room for ceremony and where our elders and youth can come together and share their knowledge in a really safe and peaceful way. And I'm just so excited to see that impact on our community.
Okay, so here's a question for you. If you had your preference, where would this be located?
My preference is Winnipeg.
Well, okay,
I'm narrowing it down to a city.
Okay, so a city of 800,000 people,
yep.
With the problems of 1.2 million, roughly.
Yeah.
So we're down to the 800,000 yep. type thing. So if I was to slide it in a little bit closer, is there any sort of area within the city of Winnipeg proper that you'd be interested in?
Yeah, so I believe that there should be at least two Indigenous co-working spaces, one on an urban reserve location for those of us who would like to take advantage of potential tax relief or those kinds of things that are available to urban reserve status users, and then a non-status location, which is the one I'm hoping to open first, either within the North End or somewhere located within easy accessibility to the core where our economics and our government are driven.
Yeah, so basically trying to be centralized and providing the space that Indigenous people can use for their business outlets. Is that
right? And eliminating the silos that have been created in the sense that only Métis or only First Nations or only Inuit people can access certain services. I want the space to be open to all, including non-Indigenous people that might want to work with us or come together in a good way to learn how they can improve our circumstances together.
Mm. If somebody wanted to get in touch with you to talk to you about this more, maybe help you out in terms of helping you realize your vision and what you're working on right now as an entrepreneur, how would they go about doing that?
Yeah, so I'm available on all social medias, whether it's Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, through Canoe Co-working. Sometimes there's a Winnipeg at the end, or the easiest way and most reliable is through email. So for those of you who like phonetics, it's Terra Tango Alpha Romeo Alpha at canoecoworking.ca, all one word, no hyphens, and it's C's for the Canoe and Co-working.
Okay. All right. So that's a great spot to get in touch with you. What a show we've been having. You're just an awesome guest. If you had a final thought for our listeners, maybe about 20 seconds or so, 25 seconds, or 20 seconds is probably what I got, what would that final thought be?
That we need to define our own success and really advocate for ourselves as individuals within a system that's created to blanket and group people into these groups where we are truly special in our own means, and however we choose to define our success has to be close to our hearts and close to who we are as people. In my case, it's very focused on my community and my family and being able to provide a means to growth and development for those individuals.
Tara, thank you very much. You're
thank you,
awesome,
Richard.
Awesome guest. You're highly articulated, articulate, and I'm not, but I appreciate your thoughts and your words. You know what? I want to take this opportunity. Obviously, I just thank you for being on here. And for our listeners, if you have a question, a thought, an idea, just send me an email at richard@setforsuccess.ca. And I want you to remember something: to do your best, invest in the success of others, and make your journey count.